It's actually not even true what he said. I think that I think that
nothing was doing much better than nothing went wrong.
In fact, I think that the paper would not have been published. Certainly not would not have been published when it was, if it had been left up to me, because. I was thinking of some other paper completely for my uncle's Festschrift, and Santo said, no, let's publish this one. It's a nice result. So I let myself be persuaded. But for me, the PR box was a big failure, a big flop. And maybe some of that will come across and even be resolved in my talk today. So thank you. It's my first time at Perlmutter Institute, and I'm happy to be here. Thank you especially to Jeff Tollickson for extending the hospitality, and to Yakir, of course, for all the other, for the invitation. By way of introduction, I'm going to try to explain this title. Many of us are engaged in the enterprise of trying to derive quantum mechanics from reasonable physical axioms, axioms that, unlike the axioms of quantum mechanics that we know, are not mathematical statements about some Hilbert space or recommendations about what kind of math you should study, but have clear and simple physical meaning, like the axioms of the special theory of relativity. So usually, I and others approach the subject of quantum mechanics from the outside. Don't assume quantum mechanics. Let's just see what the axioms lead to. And we know that relativistic causality by itself does not suffice to define quantum mechanics. So there have been various suggestions about what additional axiom would help. And my suggestion most recently, in the last couple of years, has been that the existence of a classical limit of the theory is crucial. But there are other suggestions that came before me. For example, the causality, what's the broader kind of causality called? Information causality, which is certainly a good candidate for an axiom. But rather than discuss, whose axiom is better in this, I would like to, this time, also look at quantum mechanics from the inside. I mean, I won't abandon the outside, but I'm also looking at it from the inside. Namely, I take quantum mechanics as it is, with its classical limit, so we don't have to discuss whether we need a classical limit or not. It has one. And then ask, why is quantum mechanics the way it is, given what we know? And I think that the meaning of that question will become clear quite soon. I hope so. Anyway, these are the canonical Alice and Bob. We have boxes which have somehow been prepared together in one place at some time, and now they've been distributed. Bob measures B or B prime. Alice measures A or A prime. They can't measure both. They have to measure whatever they choose to measure, and the results will be plus or minus one. And if those correlations, all those C correlations up there, are classical or local, we'll use those terms equivalently, then the Bell CHSH inequality applies. But we know that quantum mechanics violates the Bell CHSH inequality, and most of us have also done our fair share of hitting our heads against the walls. How can it be like that? However, quantum correlations are bounded from above by Cyrilson's bound, which is a theorem of quantum mechanics. And the question I'm addressing when I say the physical meaning of Cyrilson's bound, well, it's a mathematical theorem. It follows from the axioms of quantum mechanics. But what's it doing there? Why? By itself, it just seems to stand aloof from our questions what it means. So I'm going to try to answer what Cyrilson's bound means physically. So we know that a possible a possible guess doesn't work. Now, we could guess that if we make the correlation stronger than Searle-Zinn's bound, then they won't be consistent with relativistic causality. And quantum mechanics, even though it's a non-relativistic theory, can't afford to ignore relativistic causality. But if we try to make very, very strong, maximally strong correlations with the proviso that any measurement of on either side, on Bob's side or Alice's side, the probability of any result is 50%. So that automatically means that Alice and Bob can signal to each other with this so-called PR box or maximally non-local box. And so the question is left hanging, and the question, or begging, you know, why Searle-Zinn's bound? We don't need it. We can have these really strong correlations, and nobody would be the worse for it. Okay. So instead of banging our heads against the wall why quantum correlations are non-local, we can bang our heads saying, why aren't they more non-local? You know, which is what we've been doing for a number of years. So now I want to begin my explanation of what can go wrong here by showing you something rotten. Suppose Alice measures A. Well, she knows what she gets, and since her result is perfectly correlated with Bob's, well, she knows that B is equal to B prime, and it's whatever she got. And if she measures A prime, then she knows what she got, she knows what Bob will get if he measures B, and she knows what Bob will get if he measures B prime. In fact, basically, we can summarize this by saying that Alice can control Bob's observables, B and B prime, to be either the same or opposite. It just depends on what she measures. So she's exercising an enormous amount of control. She can't control what B and B prime will be, but she can correlate or anti-correlate those variables, which might seem silly because Bob can't ever check both of them. But in fact, it's not silly at all. Because look, suppose Alice measures an ensemble of pairs, half of each pair is with her, the other half is with Bob. She measures A, let's say, and then post-selects all the cases where A equals 1. So if A equals minus 1, she tells Bob, just throw that particle away, it's not relevant. And what's left with Bob's laboratory is an ensemble of particles where Alice can tell with precision B has this value. In fact, she can say all of these things that you can measure on all the particles, the result will be 1. You can only measure B or B prime, but I tell you, whichever one you choose to measure, it will be 1. And she's right. There's no question she's right. And every time Bob checks her out on whatever he can check out, that's what he gets. So there's no uncertainty principle here. There's zero uncertainty. And that's very unquantum mechanical. Now, why can't Bob then just check, I'll measure B and B prime, and I'll know what Alice measured A or A prime. That's a free bit of non-local information that I can get right away from Alice. Well, it doesn't work because it's not allowed to measure B and B prime. And why is he not allowed to measure B and B prime? Well, it's because Sandow and I said so. I mean, that's all it is, really. We said, okay, you know, we're thinking along the lines of quantum mechanics. Yeah, it makes sense. He shouldn't measure B and B prime. He should choose like Alice has to choose. But that really doesn't make any sense because there's no uncertainty principle in this theory. Bob can measure B and B prime. He can measure B or B prime, but whatever he measures, he knows Alice can tell him ahead of time what he's going to get. So there's a mismatch. There's a complementarity here in the sense that Bob is restricted in what he can measure, and Alice is restricted in what she can measure. But there's no uncertainty principle. Now, Bohr taught us that complementarity and uncertainty are very deeply related. And here there's no relationship at all. Why? So there's something unstable in this theory, because if Bob could measure B and B prime, apparently nothing would change. I mean, he knows that Alice can tell him what he's going to get anyway. So, but if he if she doesn't tell him and he looks right away, then of course that's a violation of no signaling. You can get the signal right away and cheap. So there's a kind of rotten lack of correspondence between complementarity, which is playing the role of a fig leaf. It's here to stop us from seeing nature's pudenda, from checking out, you know, from sending non-locals. I don't know if this is in bad taste or not, but this is in the Vatican. This is Hermes or Mercury in the Vatican. It's in the Vatican. Of course, it's the Vatican which put the fig leaf. It's not the. I'm just shy of taking their authority anyway. So there's something very unnatural. I've not yet disqualified the PR box, but there's something very unnatural about this whole construction. So I've mentioned the instability. What I'm going to say now is this instability kicks in when we come to the classical limit. There, instability will be disastrous, right? Because what are you going to tell me? Bob can know B, but can't know B prime. Fine. But suppose Bob measures lots of Bs and lots of B primes. He can't measure them on the same. Okay. But are you going to tell me that he can't know anything, even in some classical limit where he's handling lots and lots of pairs and he sums up all the Bs and sums up all the B primes? Are you going to tell me that even in that case, he can't know anything about both B and B prime? That doesn't make sense. That means that there's really no classical limit, because in the classical limit, there are no non-commuting variables. All the variables commute. All the observables commute. So I'm going to insist that these stronger than quantum correlations would have to have a classical limit. And that's where the fun begins. Because it's not going to be cheap, right? It's not going to be one qubit that Alice measures and immediately Bob's going to be able to inspect whether B is equal to B prime or not. You can't do that. That's not the classical limit. But let's define a classical limit in which, say, Alice and Bob share N pairs. N can be very, very big. They're going to share N pairs, and Bob is going to take the sum. We're going to define an observable in which Bob sums up the B's on all those pairs, sums up all the B primes. These are not necessarily things that he can measure precisely, but he can define them. And now there must be some kind of measurement in which Bob can get some information about big B and some information about big B prime, right? I say weak measurements. I don't want you to take me too literally. It doesn't have to be weak measurements in the sense of Yakir, but since we are inside of quantum mechanics, why not? I mean, you could certainly imagine doing very weak measurements which gives you epsilon information about both B and B prime. That's not a lot of information, but it's enough, right? The minute that Bob gets even slight information about both B and B prime, that's the end of it, because then he has some information of what Alice is signaling. Now, this is maybe not so obvious, because after all, the average value of B, big B, is zero, because it all averages out to zero, and the average of B prime is also zero. And okay, statistically, fluctuations will give you 1 over the square root of n, but also that goes to zero. But here we are at the Achilles heel of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics restricts us in lots of ways. You can't measure this, you can't measure that. But one thing that quantum mechanics does not stop us from doing is repeating our measurements over and over and over again without the slightest limit, right? So Alice and Bob can prepare n pairs at a time, and sometimes B and B prime will both average out to zero. Sometimes it will average out to 1 over square root of n. But sometimes they will be n, right? It could be that Alice measures on all of her pairs this A or A prime, and they're all the same. She gets a run of ones for A or a run of ones for A prime, which means that B will also be maximal will also be one. And that's something that is certainly observable at some, to some degree. And when he measures B equal to 1 and Alice is measuring A, then B prime is also equal to 1. And if he's measuring A prime, then B prime is equal to minus 1. And there's no way that quantum mechanics can stop us from doing this, because we can do the experiment exponentially many times, or many times exponentially, but eventually we'll do that. And I don't care how much it costs. It's not my money. And I don't care how hard Alice and Bob have to work. It's not my work. But relativistic causality doesn't say you're not allowed to send superluminal signals if it's too expensive. Relativistic causality, you're not allowed to send superluminal messages at all, period, no exceptions. And if you could make an exception, then that would be the end of relativity theory. So this is my conclusion for the meantime. All we really need to take away from this is that when Bob detects a correlation between B and B prime, even the slightest correlation, it must be more likely that Alice measured A than that she measured A prime, and then her bit is beginning to come through. Okay. So this was published in now I'm back to the language of axiom, but I think you see the correspondence. If within quantum mechanics, this is telling us why at least the beginning of an answer, why Cyrilson's bound has to be there. Because if you go all the way up to PR box correlations, if quantum mechanics allowed them, then quantum mechanics could not exist as a theory, because it would be a superluminal signaling theory. And that was published in a fest trip for Yakir. Now, on this one page, I'm going to show you an alternative proof, because the proof that I just gave you doesn't easily generalize to all stronger than quantum correlations, but this one does. So in one page, let's see. Okay, so if Alice is measuring A consistently, then both B plus B prime and B minus B prime average out to zero. But there's a big difference, because if she measures A, then B minus B prime is identically zero, right? They're both correlated the same way with A. So the results are identically zero. Whereas if she's measuring A, then B plus B prime are either equal to or minus two. It's not going to be equal to zero. So you get lots of fluctuations. So Bob will be able to detect Alice's choice of what to measure just by looking at the variances on B and B prime and B minus B prime. Okay? Maybe I should just stop and ask you a few questions. But since Bob can't read Alice's message, it means that that those variances, it means that this won't work, because here you clearly will allow Bob to distinguish between A and A prime just via the variances. And this is the argument that we're going to take to complete the job. So now let's consider all stronger than quantum correlations. SQ means stronger than quantum. I'm going to assume that from the start, they're not restricted in any way. There could be four different correlations, except that the average of each measurement is still zero, which I thought was sort of an innocuous assumption. I think in the case of the PR box, you have to assume that the correlations are average out to zero. In general, you don't. I didn't think that was a big deal, but then I had a conversation first with Ellie Wolf, and then afterwards with Sandu, and they convinced me that there might be very interesting things going on. So I haven't treated that case. I haven't treated the case where the marginals are non-zero. But so this is a restricted proof for the case where they are zero. Okay. So this is the constraint that comes from the alternative argument, namely, if Alice measures A consistently, then the standard then we'll denote the standard deviation that Bob's observed as delta A, because it's from measurements of A, of B plus B prime. Whereas if she's measuring A prime consistently, then we'll denote that by delta A prime of B plus B prime. Those are the two different variances depending on what she measures. But okay, Bob can't really just go out and measure B and B prime. There's still something of a restriction on what he, but in the limit of arbitrarily many pairs and arbitrarily precise measurements, he will be able to see a distinction. So relativistic causality forces us to state that those two variances must be the same, or those two standard deviations in this case have to be the same. That's the footprint of relativistic causality. That's the only place in the continuation of the argument where relativistic causality enters and provides a constraint. Again, I should ask if there are any questions. This is, there's not much more to go, but there's some tricky things ahead. Okay, but how do we calculate these variances? Well, in fact, it's not so easy. But we do have a constraint, not a relativistic constraint, but simply a numerical constraint, an algebraic constraint. Since if I add those two variances, then the cross terms will cancel out, and I'm left with the variances of B and B prime, which are very easy to compute because they're independent variances on all these n variables, and each variance is one. So we get and then you have n of them, so that cancels one of the factors of n, and we have the variance of B is 1 over n. And then we take this, which, if you remember, is just the relativistic constraint. This is tough algebra. It's just sticky algebra. Anyway, this comes from the relativistic constraint. This equality is just what we have up there. It's the sum of two variances equals 4 over n. And we put them together, in other words, we use this rule to get rid of the a prime, or rather to exchange the a prime with a different a prime variance. And there we are. We have a rule that says that the variance of b plus b prime when Alice measures a, plus the variance in b minus b prime when Alice measures a prime is equal to a very simple constant, 4 over n. Take a deep breath for the next one. Okay, now at this point, it becomes very useful and quite natural to define for Alice what we've already defined for Bob. Namely, Alice makes n measurements of, say, A, and let's add up her results and divide by n. So we get a capital A, which is an average of her results. And the possible values of big A are very clearly defined, because either she gets them all up, in which case she gets 1, or then 1 is down, in which case we have to take off 2 over n, and so forth. It goes down in steps of 2 over n, 2 over n, 2 over n, until everything is minus 1. And those are the probability, those are the values that A can take, big A can take, and we know exactly what the probability of each of those values is, because it's just the binomial theorem. In contrast, we can only guess the value of b plus b prime, because when Alice gets whatever she gets, it doesn't actually determine what Bob gets, unless the correlation is perfect, and we're not assuming perfect correlations. So suppose Alice obtains 1. Then we know that b actually is actually the correlation. We know that these correlations apply in that case, because she's measuring A and she's getting either B or B prime. Sorry, well, it's not quite the right way to say it. Yeah. These correlations tell us when Alice measures A, there's a certain correlation to get B and a certain correlation to get B prime, but those are actually probabilities. Once we plug in that A is equal to 1, then this simply tells us what's the probability to get, what's the expectation value of Bob's result for measuring B or and adding B prime. So this is actually the expected value of what Bob will get. So it's this is true for each individual, but it's also true for n taken at a time. So in the case that Alice gets one, then we multiply that one by this sum, and we get the expected value of B and B plus B prime. But that's not very helpful, but in terms, because all it does is help us estimate something, and yet it will turn out that we don't need a lot more than that. In general, if Alice measures a big A and gets this value, then we simply multiply her value and by that sum, by the expected value of B and B prime. B plus B prime will get smaller and smaller as Alice's big A gets smaller. But since we have a correlation, we can estimate it what it is. But actually, the value of what it is not so interesting, because it's only an estimation. There's not a lot we can do with it. However, we can say a lot more about the variances, and that's very interesting. Namely, we have here on the right delta A, which is the variance in A. We know it is what it is. It's actually square 1 over square root of n. It's the variance in A because A is a binomial distribution and so forth, and so we can be confident about that. Now, if Bob's results were perfectly correlated with Alice's, then we could just plug in this expectation value and multiply it by delta A, and that would be the variance in Bob's results. But in fact, Bob's results has a lot more variance than that, because how does he get this particular average? Well, when Alice measures one thing, he might get this thing, or he might get that thing, or in the sum, he might get it here, and then this one there, or the other way around. There's an enormous amount of variance in there. So what we can say with confidence is that the variance in B plus B prime when Alice measures A is greater than or equal to this variance that we just called. And it has all the variance in Alice's results, plus whatever additional variance comes from the fact that there's no perfect correlation here. And we can say the same thing for A prime. Okay, you should make life more difficult for me. You're all nodding and saying, yeah. I think it's straightforward, but it's still, you have to really check it out. So again, the expectation value of B minus B prime is this difference of correlations multiplied by whatever Alice gets. In this case, the standard deviation in B minus B prime when Alice measures A prime will be the same thing as analogously, except for the minus sign, because we're talking about B minus B prime. And we can assume that all these C's are positive, we can choose them all to have the same sign, whichever signs we want, actually. Okay. So above is this lemma rule which we obtained by simply expanding the variances and the cross term. That's not exactly the same one, but it does come from where we've been. Yeah, it comes from here. We derived it using the relativistic constraint and also this calculation of the individual variances. So we go back here. Okay, so we use that, and we have these two bounds on the variances, or on the standard, on the variances from the previous slide. So now we just add these two equations, this one and that one. And on the left, we get the sum of the two variances, which is up at the top. So we can simply replace the sum on the left side by 4 over n. But on the right side, we're also going to get divided by n. So we can take that those n's away and have a bound which is not quite Cyrilson's bound, but it's 4 is greater than this particular arrangement of variances. And now we use a lemma. I mean, this inequality is very easy to prove, and it's just very convenient to write it here and not get bogged down in algebra. So it means that what we proved on the previous slide with the sums of squares, we can now replace with Cyrilson's bound. And that is Cyrilson's bound as a consequence of relativistic causality in the classical limit, which must exist in quantum mechanics. I mean, obviously, it exists in quantum mechanics. So that's what I mean by saying that there's a physical meaning to Cyrilson's bound. It's not just an abstract algebraic result that we can prove using Hilbert space. It's actually telling us that if quantum mechanics were not like that, quantum mechanics could not exist as a theory, because at least not in a relativistic world. So these are my conclusions. I can even say a little bit more. Namely, that I believe that in this way we understand Cyrilson's bound much better, and that we can also regard the classical limit as an axiom which naturally takes its place alongside of relativistic causality, because in quantum mechanics is a winner of a theory, right? It's a multiple Nobel Prize winner. You know, how many Nobel Prizes have been awarded for quantum theory? And then some jerks, you know, P and R, come and say, well, what about these correlations? Well, you know, that's ridiculous. I mean, if quantum mechanics has a classical limit, then any competitor, any self-described alternative to quantum mechanics should also have a classical limit. So I think that's a very sort of natural thing. I mean, the classical limit of quantum mechanics is a very deep thing. It's not something that we perhaps understand fully even today. And the fact that Bohr always insisted on a classical world is meaningful. It's a bit strange, but it's meaningful. So I think that this is an interesting and important, maybe, result for deriving quantum mechanics. And it goes a little bit beyond that. Namely, the way I presented the algebra, you're not aware of the implications of how these things combine. But I'll tell you a story. The first time I tried to derive Cyrilson's bound, I made some assumptions about how we can combine the variance in B and the variance in B prime and so on. And I said, okay, then I'm going to have to reach that point where the variance in B plus B prime is equal to the variance in B minus B prime when Alice measures A. That condition, and you know what that condition was? It was this Bell-CHSH inequality. In other words, the first time I did this, I calculated that quantum mechanics must obey the Bell-CHSH inequality. Now, that's not very smart, right? But when I looked back on why I got that result, I realized it was because I was combining the variances in a certain way, which quantum mechanics doesn't do. Quantum mechanics combines numbers as vectors, doesn't combine numbers as scalars. And it's only when you combine, you enlarge the freedom of this derivation to include whatever, you know, just you don't tell it these are scalars. Then you get Cyrilson's bound. So there's a big hint, in addition to Cyrilson's bound, there's a big hint here that quantum mechanics or any theory which is going to provide these kind of correlations has to be founded on Hilbert space, on vectors, which I think is also a useful hint. And thank you very much for your attention. Hey, yes, please.
So one of the things that confuses me about this argument is the speed of light itself doesn't enter in.
Ah, no, I can tell you why.
Let me finish.
Yes.
So what if I had two kinds of particles that were quantum, and one had was they were like photons, the speed of light is c, but the other were something else, the speed of light is c prime. Can I run these arguments?
No.
The
answer comes from a different direction. The answer is the following. Quantum mechanics does not know anything about the speed of light. So if there are correlations that you can use for signaling, they're not dependent on the distance between two observers, right? Quantum mechanics might provide us with correlations that if we measure them, you know, Alice measures in the morning, Bob measures in the evening, and everything is cool, but they cannot be signaling. Even if there's a time-light interval between them, because if they could be used for signaling in that situation, then they could also be used for signaling when the separation is space-like. Quantum mechanics just cannot control whether the separation is space-like. There's nothing in these correlations which depends on where they're observed. So quantum mechanics actually obeys a much stronger constraint than no signaling. No signaling faster than light. It's no signaling, period.
So why the use of the word relativistic then?
Because the origin of that no signaling period is really in relativistic causality, and the fact that you can't have signaling, you know, faster than the speed of light. And if you tell that to quantum mechanics, the only way to get it through its head is to say don't signal at all, because if you signal, you will run into problems with relativistic causality, even though you don't know what you did that was so bad.
Well, okay, but you're imposing what, from the viewpoint of a relativist, well, a person who likes to play with relativity would regard maybe as too stringent a requirement. So I've had particles that have two different speeds of light, say, or two different limiting speed limits, then I guess it seems to me that in such more general theory, I might be able to use quantum correlations to break the no signaling bound with one of them. But I gather you're saying I could never even do that.
You could never do it because quantum mechanics obeys a stronger constraint, which is the only constraint which could protect, which could prevent violation of relativistic causality by quantum mechanics, namely no signaling period. That's the only way to get to that quantum mechanics can obey, can be consistent with relativistic causality, at least quantum correlations, of course. Yeah, please.
Perhaps I misunderstood the explanation now, but can you just summarize exactly the reason why you're concerned about relativistic causality in a non-relativistic theory? In simple possible terms.
Well, look, okay. Look, quantum mechanics allows me to send a ball at twice the speed of light, right? There's nothing in quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, that's, but that doesn't really bother me because I know, you know, it's a non-relativistic theory. It wasn't meant to extend to that kind of situation. And if I got out a violation of relativistic causality, it's because I put in a violation of relativistic causality. So, I mean, it's very simple to tell quantum mechanics, let's not talk about velocities greater than the speed of light, right? Let's not talk about the speeds greater than, but that works for dynamics. It does not work for the kinematics of correlations. In correlations, there's really nothing there in quantum mechanics that would stop a subluminal message signal from turning over into a superluminal message. It's just that we happen to know that, for example, you know, if these correlations are from an internal space, right? So Alice has her particles, but the particles are a product of, say, spin and position, and it's only the spin, it's this position just doesn't count. It's only the spin that carries the entanglement. So that means that the correlations are totally independent of the wave of the position states. And on that situation, you must have no signaling as a constraint, as a total constraint. And I end up answering the question the same way. I don't know if I've done justice to your question, but I think that's what I think is the issue. It's at stake.
So you can signal in quantum theory. You can have a box here, a spin half particle, a cubic, and leave it. Go to another box here, mm-hmm. and you can use that to send a signal from this box to this box. So when you say there's no signaling, you mean there's no signaling if there's no quantum system passing between the relevant boxes. But then what do you mean by saying there's no quantum system passing between the relevant boxes? Or do you mean that you know that's the case if there's no signaling? I'm worried that the thing is circular in some sense, which makes me worried that no signaling is a good axiom. Right? In the absence of the background sort of, you know, space-time structure, where you know what you mean by space-like and time-like. But in the absence of that, I worry that the circularity.
I'm sorry. Try to explain that. Okay. I mean, have you ever asked yourself why quantum correlations are no signaling, period? I mean.
No, but they are quantum. Look, I have a box here.
Yeah.
I can send from this box, I can send a qubit. I can leave this box and enter this box.
Ah, you can send matter, right.
And I can send a signal from this box to this box.
Provided the timeline separate.
Well, we just said time. We don't have space-time background here. We just have boxes with correlations between them or not.
Which signal can you send? How do you send a signal with it?
Sorry? No, I have a box here. I press a button, it spits out
a qubit
in the state 0, say.
Whatever state you want, okay.
And then over here I have another box which receives this and measures the state.
Okay, but that takes the time of the speed of light to get there.
But you just said you don't care about, you said you have no signaling full stop.
We have no signaling in the correlations. You're not talking about correlations.
This is a correlation, right?
Oh, never mind. Okay, I'm clear. I mean.
This is absolutely a correlation. I press a button.
Okay, but I'm not talking about those kinds of correlations. I'm talking about quantum correlations which involve no transfer of matter or energy.
What do you mean by matter or energy? That's another concept which doesn't really, you know, the kind of bare bones quantum theory you're talking about doesn't see, like space and time.
No, but it doesn't have to. We quantum theory. It's okay. Don't worry. You send a piece. You send a qubit. You'll be all right. Because we know that qubit will not move faster than light. So we don't have to tell quantum mechanics. We don't have to be so strict with quantum mechanics there, because quantum mechanics will not break out of relativistic causality. That's not where the danger lies. The danger lies with correlations which don't involve any kind of matter.
But I think it's fine if you know. You're using some of quantum theory, like you're talking about connecting boxes by systems or not, if you're allowing yourself to draw wires or not. Because you don't want to assume Hilbert space. You're not assuming that there are qubits, or you're assuming that there are boxes that have wires between them or don't have wires between them. And you want to say, specifically when you have.
I'm very stupid. I never figured out what wiring is. Well, I sort of. Yeah.
No. Well, all I'm trying to say is there are some implicit assumptions about there being wires or no wires. And what you're saying is there's no signaling when there are no wires. So there's a whole story about wires.
But in wiring, as I understand, you take the output of something, you put it into something else, right?
The output is a quantum particle, so it's.
Okay, well, it could be a
mystery.
Yeah, okay, but in any case, you're not in danger of violating the, of surpassing the speed of light. You're not going to, there's no way you to do it, there's nothing to worry about. I don't have to constrain quantum mechanics about that. Quantum mechanics would be okay without me.
Well,
I don't, God, yeah.
Okay. So what if I weakened your condition, like I think of all the argument on delta plus B prime.
Should we go back a bit, yeah.
B minus B prime, right? So, yeah, that thing. Mm-hmm. So suppose I weaken that a little bit and I say the rate are not exactly equal, but the one is alpha times the other. What would I then conclude about the causal structure of space-time? Suppose I did not believe in that condition. I put a little parameter in there that says those two variances are not exactly equal. I'm willing to tolerate.
They're not exactly equal. These are only lower bounds.
Well, in the previous slide, you had some.
Sorry.
No, four.
Yeah, I know.
Right. The locality.
Yeah. That's wherever. Yeah.
This one.
That way, that's the blue box.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose I weaken that condition.
Yeah.
So there's a parameter between them, and I don't demand that parameter as unity. And I run through the argument. What could I then conclude about the causal structure of space-time, or maybe what Lucien says about sending correlations?
Yeah.
So I should be able to conclude something, should I not? But I don't see, obviously, what it would be.
That Alice and Bob have to work twice as hard and spend twice as much money. I mean,
it's not my work and it's not my money, so.
Right. Fine. So we're both happy. I mean.
You're right.
This is not, you know, it is not a straightforward thing to claim because Bob is still not supposed to measure B and B prime. So how can he measure B plus B prime? But you, I mean, if you say up to here and no further, then you're not allowing the classical limit to kick in. There's nothing inherent in the thing.
I don't know what the classical limit means.
It means that at some point we're talking about commuting observables. All observables commute they're simultaneously measurable, and that's
it. Simultaneous presumes a structure of causality, and that's precisely the question in place. I don't know what simultaneity means unless I have some concept of space-time structure.
Simultaneous, it just means you can measure both of these things without an uncertainty principle, preventing you from knowing both.
Yeah, I used it simultaneously, maybe injudiciously. Well, I'm not talking about time.
I think it depends on, that's why I want to, what if I play around with the blue box a little bit? I want to know what I can conclude about causal relationships, or maybe what you said, but I presumably something is going to happen, right? Well, that's what I'm asking.
What I'm saying is that any effect like what you're talking about that would allow me to somehow get around would have to prove in the long run to be a fluke. It would have to prove in the long run to be a fluke, because if it was not a fluke, if it's not an error, then we have a violation of relativistic causality, of no signaling, no matter how small and no matter how...
Well, maybe we do, but what kind of violation is it is the question. That's my question.
It's a superliminal signal.
Probably will, but you know, maybe there are some quantum particles that love the blue box and others that don't like it so much. Right? We have no idea whether highly unstable subatomic particles actually obey these correlations. They've never been directly tested.
No, but you can't afford to violate.
It's not my money.
No. It's not your money. It's not my money. There we agree. But you cannot, in the long run, afford. To have Alice signaling to Bob at whatever expense and whatever efforts, because then you don't have a relativistic theory. You cannot have, you know, the world cannot exist half in consistent with relativistic causality and half not inconsistent with relativistic causality. It's a very nice constraint, this relativistic causality. It really gets you far.
Actually, I think you can, but that's maybe a private discussion.
Fine. And it showed to me, but I would be very grateful to anybody who could make me aware of an error that I'm making. Yes, Okata.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Is a confirmation that the maximum value of the 2 square root 2 is a certain condition. Is a Chisholm bound from the standard quantum mechanical theory. This is sort of Alexander Bob's such a specific to the measurement outcome, measurement to the axis is a we measure. Then so we can get the 2 square root 2. But your cases seem to be that this is the maximum value of the 2 square root 2. That's from that, law seems to be described as this condition. But this kind of a condition acting on that such kind of inequality, that all the equality condition is satisfied, we can get the 2 square root 2.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be contradicts the situation. How to interpret that?
I'm not sure I got your question, but I think the answer is that this proof actually it seems to be too easy almost. Right? I'm using so little information about the variances, and it brings me down to two square root of two for this. Sum of correlations, which is Tyrrellson's bound. And I know that I can't go below that because we have quantum violations of, we can saturate that Tyrrellson's bound with quantum correlations. So.
That's the condition. It seems to be different from that point of view. There's a stronger than this quantum correlation. This is the maximum state of that, the maximum. 2 square root 2 is an equal condition. That's the seems to be the A and B is a such kind of choosing of that some parameter. Then this is I don't understand that this kind of condition physically.
Which condition? Sorry.
That's to satisfy the maximum value, 2 squared root 2.
Are you asking whether this is the best possible bound?
Yeah. The best possible bound. What's the physical condition?
The tightest bound you can make.
Yeah. Maybe I can ask you a different question.
Of course you can. You cannot make it better than that because we know quantum mechanics saturates the bound, so it's the best we can do.
Simple as that.
Yeah. Such kind of condition is the such kind of quantum state is can satisfy the 2 squared root 2. In some sense, in that the in his context. Such kind of condition seems to be satisfied.
That's
satisfied.
That's the best possible.
Yeah, also proof. But this is a physical.
Is it physical?
Yes, this is a physical condition. Is that?
Yeah, it's saying something very physical. It says that quantum mechanics is a theory that's that the correlations of quantum mechanics are consistent with relativistic causality. That's a very physical reason. Lydia, right?
Just to try to understand if I got the message correctly. So I think non-signaling is a natural principle to demand of a theory if one assumes relativity. And what you're showing here is that with PR boxes, you could signal. You can connect like copies of the measurement. So what you're saying is that when people do things like putting the PR box inside the non-signaling polytope, there is a very restricted notion of non-signaling.
Yeah, they're very restricted because they don't consider the relativist. They don't consider the classical limit at all. And from their point of view, they're justified. I mean, I don't want to go. I actually had this quandary because I thought now that I believe that PR box violates relativistic causality, because I think there has to be. Should I go and tell people no? It was 20 years ago, I said something that was not right. No, it's going to just confuse people. So I'll stick to what I said. PR box in the classical limit violates causality.
The classical limit is just one example of something people could do. So if you can read a classical limit, then you can violate non-signaling. So, I mean, it just means that you'd be using the wrong definition of non-signaling. You can tell people I fooled you for.
No, I want to stay clear of that. But if you're what I'm saying is that in the classical limit, I will say there has to be a classical limit. But anyway, in the classical limit, these boxes don't qualify anymore as a generalization of quantum mechanics.
And does classical limit mean anything more than having many copies of this?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does because you could certainly imagine having an unlimited number of boxes, but you just don't consider wholesale measurements. You don't consider these, what are they called, collective measurements. These are collective measurements. If you don't talk about collective measurements and you don't make some argument about what happens to the uncertainty with which precision with which Bob can measure from both of these, then you're safe. But I think, I recently saw a paper which claimed that, maybe in string theory we can have PR box correlations. But I don't believe that because in that case, we're still in the quantum world, and I think that any theory which would contain PR box correlations would be inconsistent with relativistic causality, period.
What do you know about how much this argument generalizes to other Bell scenarios? So if you have more outcomes.
You mean like beyond bipartite?
Maybe even just bipartite with more inputs and more outputs. You have other Bell inequalities and you have other Thielson like bounds. So can you derive any of those?
I haven't. That's a very good question because the people who claim that they can, they're people who claim that they can derive Cyrilson's bound from a different kind of assumption, but they can't derive, they can't rule out other kinds of correlations that quantum mechanics doesn't have. Okay, so that's an open question. What I can say one thing about it. As an exercise, I decided to take GHZ correlations. Now, GHZ correlations are like kind of like a version of PR boxes because they give all or nothing results. So I thought, okay, suppose you have Alice, Bob, and Claire, and they each have one of the triplet of systems, and they have lots and lots of triplets. Could they use something like this to signal? I mean, could this argument show that Alice can signal to Bob and Claire? I mean, if she can, then this argument is obviously flawed. I mean, I don't know where the flaw is, but if you use GHZ triplets, you find that the probability for Alice's qubit, Alice's bit to get through is exactly the same as the probability for that same result to appear when Alice isn't even bothering to measure anything. So there's no chance to use this kind of argument to or scheme to signal using GHC triplets. So that's a very small step in that direction. Yes.
So the bigger problem here is reconstructing quantum theory, not just the Cyrilson bound, but all of quantum theory. So the question, you mentioned some hints about that in the vector structure. Do you see this being part of a bigger reconstruction of quantum theory? Is that sort of deep in the village?
Well, yes, that's obviously an aspiration. But the fact that I'm using the quantum, the classical limit, and not something like information causality, is already kind of a statement, because I think the classical limit is a very, very physical, very deeply meaningful physical statement. Whereas information causality, fine. But I think that there's a trend to think that information theory is now going to give us everything, and I don't go along with that trend. Quantum mechanics is not just about correlations; it also has equations of motion. It has, Hamiltonian. There's energy. I don't think that information is a substitute for all of those things. So while I don't think that even Hilbert space, that's the structure of the space, but it's not going to give us Schrödinger's equation. So I would like, alongside of this kind of reasoning, to find sources of sort of some additional axiom that will put us on the road to understanding quantum dynamics, and that's not here, and I don't expect to find it here. Okay.
Are there any more questions? Let's thank Daniel for a panel.